Chapter 2. The ship is moving. The cultivator of the Engenarium, Ro Tway, has succeeded in firing the third furnace, and there is fire and ichor chandering down the tubes again. More of the lanterns come on, flickering first, then throwing out that familiar dirty yellow glow from behind glass panels. The population is stirring. Many of them were killed, either by hard round void barrage or by the corpse spawn who got on board after the shields were knocked out. But there are thousands living in the dark deeps, and it is hard to get all of them. They have white skin that sags from their calcified cartilage, black in black eyes, and fingers made long and tough from the things they have to prize open. Some of them might still be technically human, though most have moved on to alternative taxonomic classes. The variety is interesting. They dwell in the parts of the Solace that few of the Unbroken have reason to travel into, save, perhaps, for sport or to hunt. The ship is huge, and so there are many of these places. When the ship's hull was laid down in the 34th millennium on the forge world Lashtay, it was named Undying Valor. It entered service with Battlefleet Archon less than a year after structure completion, commanded by an inexperienced captain named Lutretia Prask. Its complement of more than 30,000 ratings was largely drawn from naval levy stations strung out beyond the Morn Ring, and was graded as competent by four subsequent inspection visits. Like all Coronis-class cruisers, it was heavily armed, with lance and macro-cannon arrays out of proportion to its relatively underweight shielding. It transpired that the class gradually fell out of favour with Imperial commanders, though the Undying Valor served with distinction for another 500 years, gaining a kill ratio marginally higher than its reputation indicated likely. Prask died in an engagement less than 20 years after assuming command, and was replaced by a succession of captains promoted from the lower decks. A cruiser-class ship was a world of its own, and only the very greatest battleships regularly recruited senior officers from outside the hull. Most captains were born, raised, and trained on the ship they would later command. The last of the line, Orthon Hemo, was of this tradition, and was said to have loved the ship more than his own children, of which there were 20 before circumstances intervened to curtail his commendable contribution to the replenishment of Imperial numbers. Those circumstances came at the Battle of the Borghese Channel, a vicious encounter in which the Imperium lost 20 vessels and had its grip loosened on three subsectors. By the time retribution fleets overwhelmed the region more than 60 standard years later, there was no sign of the Undying Valor and its last reported coordinates, only a slowly spinning core of metal, to which Hemo's deep-frozen corpse was, it was rumoured later, nailed on tight. And that was that. The Coronis class continued their long decline in Imperial service. When variants reappeared in the sporadic warfare of later centuries, they had been changed by the heavy corrosion of the eye, sporting modifications and eruptions that baffled, excited, and appalled the tech priests who studied them. One unnamed scholar, toiling away in some obscure Forge World's collation citadel, amended his report on these studies, changing the term Coronis to repulsive, possibly as some recondite form of Martian humour. The Mechanicus, not being a humorous order, took up the emendation as purely literal, and like some spreading organic virus, it became the preferred classification for what remained a rare class of warship within Imperial zones of control. Vaux did not seize the Undying Valor. By the time he became its master, it was already Solace, and was already growing, changing, spiralling slowly down those deep wells of the eye, and soaking up their bottomless malice. For more than 5,000 years it steeped in that soul liquor, its spars flexing, its innards burning, its hull plates blistering. Its old core began to reform, untouched by demon rites or renegade tech marines, but impelled by its own semi-dormant creative impulse. Like so much else in that realm of dreams, physical form began to suffuse with a matter of souls. Now it breathes. It has respiration. It has circulation. It has whims, and it has moods. If it turns against you, you find corridors suddenly choked with bulging plates and boiling pits of runoff oil. Crew go missing from time to time, even from the ranks of the Unbroken. Sometimes they are discovered much later, bits of armour, stains on the deck, a faint smell of satisfied ingestion. Solace must be placated, it must be nourished, and it must be tended. If that is done, then it will fight for you, and it is very good at that. It is bulkier than it once was, heavier and thicker, and caked with steadily accumulated demorganic detritus, so much so that the old weakness in defence is no longer really there. It is a monster. It is a killing beast, a void wallower, a devourer of the corpse spawn's empty iron machines. But it is not invincible. It has been hurt now. Its skeleton has been partly exposed, and huge strips of flesh burned into ash. It is off-centre, listing with its grav-pull askew as the stars wheel slowly around it. It gasps, sending plumes of red-tinged smoke seeping into the void. Its main plasma thrusters are black and cold, though Rotway has kindled the third furnace now. The levels aft of the plasma generators are still dark. Clado hurries through them, accompanied by four of his Unbroken bodyguards. His armour is badly damaged, the needle arrays twisted and leaking, and there are sparks of strange electricity snaking over the plate. He is carrying two functional weapons, one in each hand. The first is a bolt pistol, its muzzle fashioned into the gaping jaws of some venomous species of blind slug. The second is attached to his forearm, an old Narthesium with its scissor-saw mandibles intact and the vacuum chamber working at near optimal performance. That is a rare thing, and its owner is keen to use it.
"Up ahead,"
growls one of the bodyguard, an Unbroken captain named Golk. Golk limps. One of his legs is wasted away within its armour shell, yet still supports his considerable bulk. The bones are shot to powder, the muscles are a stringy mess, and yet he still walks. Such mysteries. Clado does not respond. He already senses what he has come for. He can smell it somehow amid the rich tapestry of stinks in the underbelly of the starship. A surgeon of the Death Guard learns to navigate by smells, the acrid puff of terror, the sweet and drawn-out fug of despair, the perennially exciting moment when a barren body is first infected and the infinite joys are unleashed within its bloodstreams and limbic systems. The population are scattering before him, splashing off into the darkness. They are like rats, squeezing into every hole that will take them. The rusted iron of Solace's skeleton is intricate here, but still hot after the bombardment. There are places open to the void, and they must go carefully. They pass the carcass of a boarding torpedo some way back, burning in defiance of the void's vacuum. Its livery was a deep sable, displaying the chapter symbol of the iron shades of the Shoba Death World. Clado knows all the liveries. They've been studying their enemy for a long time, and there are only 1,000-odd chapters to master. The iron shades are a good enemy, tenacious and unrelenting. They have a philosophical disinterest that marks them out from their many peers. Their commitment to martial excellence is aesthetical as much as it is anything. They fight because they believe perfection is achieved through contest. Clado knows that this is nonsense. Fighting is mostly pointless, but if it has an end, that end is for some greater political purpose, such as putting the wheezing old super-psychic husk on Terra out of its misery and calling a stop to the whole sorry charade. In itself, considered in the abstract, fighting is little more than belching, a necessary part of life, but hardly the most distinguished. The smell becomes more intense. He hurries, his boots kicking up slurry. He can see bolt impact craters in the walls, already thickening with milky liquid. Bodies are everywhere, slumped and folded and floating in the scum-topped pools. God of decay, but they killed a lot of menials. He enters a hemispherical chamber. A bolt gun cracks out, flashing vividly and making the walls and roof burn white. He is hit twice, once in the chest, once in the leg. The aim is good, and he feels the pain of the impacts. His bodyguards return fire instantly, carpeting the far wall with a range of esoteric, more powerful weaponry. He hears grunts from the other side of the inferno and holds his Narthesium hand up to halt the destruction. Steam hisses, bilge water slaps and boils. Cleto can feel his wounds close over. He can feel the bolt shells dissolving inside him, burned away by the acids within, and the pus oozing from his glands, coating the wounds and dribbling down the inside of his thick, soft armor plate. Once, his protective ceramite would have aimed to keep projectiles away from him. Now it absorbs them, sucking them in close, chewing and corroding the layers of diamantine and depleted uranium and cordite and, best of all, the sickly sweet propulsive fluids. He barely breaks stride. He sees the Iron Shade Space Marine clatter to the floor, his armor riddled with catastrophic damage. Cleto takes in the tactical markers instantly. This one is from the 5th Battle Company, Void War Specialists. He comes closer and sees the sigils of distinguished service. His armor was already carrying damage, and now it's just a mess of shards and bloody flecks. He can see a face, gaunt, grey, studded with carapace plugs and honor tattoos. One eye stares at him. The Space Marine's fingers try to move. Cleto kneels down. The smell is overwhelming now.
"Pretty good,"
he whispers, as the Narthesium begins to whine up to speed.
"You got a long way in."
The Iron Shade tries to rise, to fight, to reach for a blade. It's pointless. His sinews are severed, his heart's hemorrhaging.
"But I'm feeling a bit unreasonable at the moment."
Cleto selects a needle from the cycler and slots it into the Narthesium's array. He presses it against the flesh of the Space Marine's neck.
"A bit put out."
The Iron Shade almost manages to move, to get to that dagger at his belt that is just so tantalizingly close. Cleto depresses the plunger.
"I'd normally be taking your progenoids," he says. "Don't worry, I'll be doing that soon enough."
The Space Marine's bloodshot eyes widen. He's tough, and he's trained, but there are pains beyond belief, and Cleto knows them all.
"See, I was already irritated,"
the surgeon says,
"and then you shot me."
The sores spin and then hover closer. An old, sick light kindles in Cleto's eyes.
"So this is going to be horrible,"
he says, and begins. Dragan is furious. This is not the low-level habitual fury that animates his every breath and drives his every killing blow, but a precise fury directed at ignorance. They were fighting and being stretched, and then something happened. He was ripped away, thrown out into darkness as the ship reeled, and now they are... He does not know where they are. Dragan hates not knowing. His deadliness is built on certainty. He is not as old as some of his brothers. He was not spawned on Barbarous, but on an imperial world, and that fact worms away at him. You have to prove yourself in this environment, and any little thing can be made into a weapon against you. You have to work to turn those disadvantages into weapons you can use. And, see, so much of all the old prestige is no better than new shit. It doesn't matter. Vorks was spawned 10,000 years ago on a world now rendered inert by virus bombs, and Dragan was spawned 2,000 years ago on some imperial hive cluster that is, as far as he knows, still very much in active life. What does that mean? That Vorks has 8,000 more years of experience under his sagging belt? No, it does not. It means nothing. Dragan has met creatures birthed at the dawn of the Imperial Age whose voyages in the Eye have given them less subjective life experience than he has. It matters not where one comes from, nor on what world one's cells first fused together. It only matters what one does once the choked breaths start coming. In a similar vein, he has thought from time to time on the experience of the Primarchs. Those demented paragons lived a real life only for a couple of centuries before being hurled back into their elemental prisons. There they squatted amid failure and sucked their yellowing teeth. They consulted grimoire and they built altars. They had less exposure to the realm of the real than he has had. Thus, Dragon cultivates his contempt for the Primarchs. Not quite for his own, of course. In the Death Guard, rank and suzerainty still have weight. But even then, there is that old paradox. The Imperials only venerate their Primarchs because they are all dead. If any lived, they would soon remember what fools they were and despise them too. A long time ago, Slurt had taken Dragon down to the underpiles of the engine runoff chamber. Slurt had found something that piqued his obsessive interest, an insectoid hive, all wattles and hexagons running off into darkness, crammed with buzzing sting nightmares with jade eyes and dragging flails. The species, it seemed, was entirely novel, some kind of emergent fusion of blowfly and void wasp. The drones had dragged some of the population into their colony, injecting larvae under flabby skin as the wretches wriggled and twitched. Slurt had burned his way deep into the hive, ignoring the stings that pumped fresh and welcome poisons into him. In the pulsing heart of that place, he found the queen. The thing was impressively grotesque, swollen beyond reason, with a translucent sac that quivered as it squirted out glossy eggs. He had shown this to Dragon, as if some great lesson were revealed by it.
"What is this?" Dragon asked. "Of all the creatures," Slurt said, "this is the only one that never leaves the hive. They feed it. They feed it until its flesh stretches and it cannot get out."
The putrefier looked at Dragon in the dark, his rotted death mask partly hidden behind the swarms.
"So the queen is the slave."
It was an unsubtle point. Slurt had a tendency to hammer these things home. Back then, though, the observation had more currency. The Primarchs were still slumped on their self-made dream worlds, rolling around in acrimony and self-loathing, and unable to leave them. Only the Despoiler had had the belly fire to strike out beyond the gate's reach in numbers, demonstrating at a stroke the indulgence and passivity of the Elder Order. Ah, the Despoiler. There is a conundrum. Dragon goes faster now. He vaults stairs and climbs up through the flickering dark. Everything has changed. The old lords are stirring again, breaking out through the breach carved for them by Abaddon's ambition. Certainty, honed over millennia, has been fractured. It was never supposed to play out like this, and Dragon suspects that now they're out, the old Legion Masters will go ahead and foul things up again just as they did before. That makes him angry. It is the source of much of his current anger. He can no longer cleave to a path that had once seemed utterly secure. He will have to improvise, ride the changes, see just how much stupidity the Lords of Silence will put up with from Vorks before it comes down to blades. He reaches the antechamber just below the sensorium bridge. He can hear commotion, shouting from the unchanged, and even growls and barked orders from the unbroken. Heavy machinery is being dragged around by chain gangs, and it makes the sagging decks shed rust flakes. By the time he reaches the access hatch, it has become a cacophony, and the disorder irritates him. He meets Hovik just before the piston lift to the next level. The ship's master looks unsteady. She has a gash on her forehead, and her hair has come undone from its bun.
"What happened?" Dragon asks.
He towers over her. Hovik was once taller, but she is diminishing now, fattening, being crushed into a ball by her plagues. When she breathes, it is with a wheeze, and her cheeks are mottled red.
"I think,"
she begins, then reaches for a bulkhead for support.
"I think the warp drives."
Dragon hesitates.
"Ignited?"
"Not fully, and I do not know why yet."
She swallows, and a pop of yellow liquid marks the corner of her mouth.
"Maybe not the warp drives."
She is not focusing well. Dragon looks beyond her, up into the lift shaft from where more thunks of bulky equipment are coming.
A mess, he spits. Where is the siege master?
I do not know.
He's not on the bridge?
The bridge is a wreck, Lord.
And then he has a brief flicker of concern. Vaux might have died. He might have been crushed by something, destroyed by a hand other than Dragon's own. He moves towards the elevator entrance, going faster now, ignoring Hovik as she gradually squats down on the deck, retching. He reaches the access platform and sees the carnage for himself. There are unbroken corpses among the wreckage, lit by the sparking flash of electrics going off. Armor glass has shattered, flecking the decks with a glinting carpet of shards. Far above him are octagonal real viewer blisters, clustered like compound eye lenses. He can see the void through them, and for a moment thinks he catches the dark grey slab that was the Iron Shade's vessel. But even during the engagement, that ship never got properly close. They had pummeled one another from thousands of kilometers away, hurling plasma across a burning void. Only the boarding teams had given the fight anything like a proper character, and Dragon had at least tasted the blood of the enemy before the wrench into oblivion pulled everything apart. If Hovik was right, something had gone strangely awry. It took hours to prime the warp furnaces. The navigators needed to be hauled from their incubator cells and plugged into Solus's nexus. Then again, it was unclear whether navigators, even the vat-gorged horrors the Legion cultivated, were of much use now. The corpse spawn's beacon is stuttering, ran the rumours. Even so, warp drives do not just ignite. Dragon strides through the detritus. His boot crunches through a supine servitor, and it barely coughs as its femur snaps. He sees the empty throne ahead of him, rising out of a jumble of wreckage. There are surf crew milling around it, trying to clear the worst of the debris away, but the seat itself is empty. Dragon looks at it. He looks at the way the arms curve out, built for the dimensions of a human normal, but steadily augmented by Solus's slow mutations, so that an unbroken master can be accommodated in suitable majesty. He considers the gravid weight of the columns. He notes the faded verdigris on the old copper and believes he can still make out the eroded impression of an aquila somewhere in all that bulbous metalwork. He sees the sign of the closed lips over the headrest, the sigil of the Lords of Silence, streaked with oil. The throne cannot remain empty. That is the first principle. He looks at it for a long time. Then he hears voices, commands, requests for commands, cries for help. Hovik has followed him in, and other senior crew are crawling back to their stations. A plasma chamber bursts into life, flaring lime green behind the crystal frontage. Vaux isn't here. Someone needs to take charge. Dragon strides down from the empty throne.
Get us augurs, he barks at the sensorium pits. We're blind, and I want eyes.
He keeps half a glance on the real viewers. The stars look strange.
Where are we? He thinks.